folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with me, Dr. Brian Gurman, assistant professor of theology here at the university, the director of the Concordia Bible Institute. You may have heard the phrase that there is nothing new under the sun, and I'm telling you today that we have a new podcast series, I'm trying to be clever here, on the book of Ecclesiastes. Yeah, that's right, we had a nice little journey through the Psalms, 50 podcasts, by the way, on the book of the Psalms. I encourage you to go back and listen to some of those if you missed those. We did a total of 50 Psalms podcasts, 15 months I think it took us, and now it's time for a new day. And yet, the book we're going to study is telling us there's nothing new under the sun. What are we going to do with that? Well, we'll have lots to say about that in due course. But here we are with a new series on Ecclesiastes, Kohelet. I hope you enjoy it. It's a fascinating book. Have you read the thing? It's a bit strange, a little odd. Parts of it very puzzling, and I don't quite know what to do with it. In fact, I got to admit, part of the reason to jump into this as a new series is that there are just parts of this that I still kind of... fascinating, but I scratch my head. How best to work through some of this? Some of it seems pretty straightforward, and yeah, you might look at it and say, well, that's pretty depressing or whatever, but at least it's, you know, it has the clarity there. But other parts going to take a little work. So I'm excited to jump into this with you. I think at the end of the day, I remember a seminary prof coming into class once. He had his earbuds in, and he just said, well, I just finished listening to the most depressing book of the Bible. And he was talking about Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. So that's, I mean, it has that. We're going to talk about all this, hopefully, today as we get into the first chapter. But yeah, it's an odd book. And yet at the same time, in the midst of this sort of tension that we see here in the book. We'll talk about all this and as we move along, but in the midst of all this, I think Ecclesiastes also has a kind of a profound voice to offer in the choir of sacred scripture. It gives a kind of richness and depth to the Bible, and that otherwise wouldn't be there if you just kind of thought of the Bible as a bunch of fairy tales and nice. And no, this is... Bible is down to earth as it gets. It doesn't get any better than knowing a thing or two about us, better than we know ourselves. And Ecclesiastes, I just think it's fascinating. So let's talk a little bit by way of introduction. What kind of book is it? I mean, well, I guess there are a lot of different types of material in this thing. You have proverbs in there, like individual proverbs. You've got sort of an autobiographical kind of feel too. We'll have a couple different voices come here. You have the Kohelet itself. That's the Hebrew term for the book. Kohelet, from kahal, to gather, to assemble. So this guy, he's an assembler. He's a gatherer. He might be a preacher of some sort. I think Luther translated as preacher. He reflects on things. He's got poems on things. He asks rhetorical questions on things. He even has some woes and blessings and even a command and prohibition. All kinds of different, you know, if you try to pin it down in a certain literary genre, that's hard to do. So you got all kinds of things going on. You have his voice, the voice of Kohelet, but you also have a narrator that you can see pop up at the beginning and the end that presents to you the voice of Kohelet. So part of the difficulty of this book, I mean, there are a lot of difficulties, and we're going to jump in, but part of these is just keeping these voices straight. You have Kohelet as a kind of main figure, the preacher, the gatherer, the kahaler, the gatherer, the assembler. And then you also have the narrator, somebody who's presenting to you what Kohelet said. So you have like a narrator's voice, and then you have Kohelet's voice, and then who's the implied author and here and that. We're going to have to think that through as we move along. This thing has enjoyed all kinds of different understandings in the history of interpretation. This is what I like to do. I kind of like, I don't know, not everybody, it's kind of boring, I guess, but I really like digging into how this thing has been understood in the history of not only the church, but also the synagogue, but especially the church. You get kind of, I suppose, three main strands of understanding this book. Again, this is the vanity of vanities. Everything is vanity. I set my heart to figure out wisdom, and I don't know. I don't understand it. It's driving me nuts. That's all. I can't figure anything out. Eat, drink, and enjoy your work if you can. That's all I got. How do you understand this thing? Well, Jerome, fourth century, way back, kind of set it straight. He blazed a trail that, he had this understanding of the book that was basically saying, well, if that's the case, then we should be utterly full of utter contempt for the world. Well, there's nothing new under vanity of vanity. Well, forget it then. Go live in a cave and enjoy the ascetic life, the kind of go be a monk sort of thing. Leave the world, flee everything material sort of thing. And that was huge. That understanding back in the fourth, it dominated up until the time of the Reformation. Luther comes around and he hated that view. He said, you are not doing justice to the book of Ecclesiastes. When Luther saw the vanity of vanities and went from there, he thought this was not so much the world, the creation is a good gift from God. Albeit broken, the Lord still works through it and does amazing. He saw this, the vanity, more in terms of the human condition. You want to talk about vanity, you want to talk about what's in vain, and that's the human heart. At one point, Luther said that the heart is like a constantly yawning chasm. It's insatiable. Even when it has everything, it's still not satisfied. Even when it has everything, it's still looking for the next thing. And so on the one hand, you have the vanity of the human condition, but you also have the kind of the goodness of God's creation. And how do you work through that? There's a tension there. And Ecclesiastes is how to kind of navigate through the language Luther used was via media, the middle way. How do you kind of balance between, is really between pride and despair, the two pitfalls of humanity. Whatever it is that's going, you know, how, what is it, if you don't want anything to do with the Christian faith and the gospel, you're basically left with pride and despair. Take your pick. Usually that's a roller coaster back and forth. How's that working out for you? The two pitfalls of humanity. The only thing that is that kind of middle road or how to navigate through those things is forgiveness in the gospel for the pride and everything that flows from it, and the meaning, the purpose, the value, the life, and that eternal, so that there is not despair. That's the only thing that's going to get you out of it. Otherwise, I mean, how's that working out for you? I don't understand. I mean, without the gospel, what would we? So anyway, Jerome, he does this thing. Luther comes around. He's got this, you know, don't have contempt for the world, Jerome. You're messing it up. But just remember that the human condition is such. And now the third main kind of strand, I guess if I can categorize them in three, and now you have the post-Enlightenment, which is just a mess ever since the 19th century, basically. It's fragmented. It's pluralistic. You look at Ecclesiastes in a bazillion different ways. There's really no consensus on how to understand the book. There are special readings. There are all kinds of different readings, psychological analysis of Kohelet. Maybe he was, you know, he suffered from chronic depression. Here's why and all of this. It's just kind of a mess. So with that, here we go. Let's jump into the book. I'm sorry. I'm battling a cold here. Nothing new under the sun except for this cold that came and hit me like a 2x4 in the face. All right. Other than that, so let's talk about it. Now, who wrote the thing? Oh, dear. I might get in a little trouble here. Traditionally speaking, it was basically always granted to Solomon. Now, why is that? Well, verse 1, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Well, who is that? You know, son of David, king in Jerusalem. That pretty much narrows it down. So you're dealing with Solomon. Although Luther himself kind of went back and forth on this. He was really, so far as I can tell, Luther was the first to deny that Solomon wrote this thing. He did, at one point in his life, he said, yeah, it was probably Solomon. But then in his table talk, think about the book itself, Luther said, and it was probably the case that his disciples or whatever gathered things for him. Maybe they're words of Solomon, but Solomon writing the thing, maybe not. And on a very kind of plain sense level, it makes sense to me that it's probably a little bit more involved than just strictly speaking, Solomon sitting down in one shot in his closet and writing this book from beginning. I mean, just think about the very book. We're going to get into this hopefully today. But you have a narrator's voice as well. He's saying, I'm going to report to you the things that Kohelet, the preacher, said. That voice comes up, of the narrator's voice comes up at the beginning and the end. And he also have these phrases that are hard to, like when he says, when the preacher, when Kohelet says, all those before me reigning in Jerusalem. Well, that doesn't make any sense. There's only one. I mean, how do we, so all those before me reigning in Jerusalem, that's just David reigning in Jerusalem. Plus the fact that Solomon is not mentioned by name as he is, for example, in other wisdom texts like Proverbs mentions Solomon. We don't have Solomon's name here. And he gradually, that kind of figure gradually disappears. So the first couple chapters, yeah, you kind of think Solomonically. I don't think that's a word, but it is today. There's nothing new except for this new word. I'm going to do that a lot. Bear with me. And also the fact that, so that he gradually disappears, that Solomonic figure. And also the fact that this thing is just, I mean, the Hebrew is very late. There's Aramaic words all over. There's stuff that occurs here and also in Ben Sira, very late text, second century, maybe something like that. It just seems to me that it's kind of, but at the same time, I mean, I don't know how much we can push this in terms of Saul. I don't know how much defense could be brought forward and say, no, this Solomon wrote it and that's the end of the deal. And yet at the same time, the Solomonic figure, son of David, king of Jerusalem, is important. And we're going to have to, why is that? It kind of drives me nuts. We'll have to think about that as we move forward. Why is that kind of association, at least I kind of prefer to speak of it in terms of associating this with Solomon, why is that important for Ecclesiastes' message? With that said, I mean, that's a thing, just an afterthought on that. I mean, you get the sense that here's that if you, the figure, Kohelet, Solomonic kind of guy, he's got all the wisdom, he's got all the, I'm going to set my heart, you get the, on the one hand, it's think Solomon as in the epitome of wisdom. And on the other hand, it's I'm going to try my best at getting a bunch of people, having parties, getting women, buying lands. I'm going to have farms and vineyards and all of these things. And it's not, you get the sense that another form of wisdom is being put to the test and it comes up in vain. And then at the end of the book, I mean, just kind of give away the ending, it's going to circle back and say, well, at the end of the day, just remember your creator, fear God and keep his commandments. And that's not unlike, that's not unlike Proverbs where it grounds all wisdom in the fear of the Lord. So in some ways, Ecclesiastes is a bit of a journey. I mean, again, we're thinking Solomon here as like wisdom par excellence, and we're invited to go on this journey with him. And in some sense, it's going to come full circle. And yet at the same time, the point, the message of the book really makes sense as we make our way through it, as opposed to just kind of ripping out one phrase, vanity of vanities, and then slapping a kind of label on the world as in, there's no meaning anywhere and just forget about life. All right. With that said, so there's not a lot of Ecclesiastes in the New Testament. You might make the case. There's one quote, I guess, in Romans 3, all of sin, about everyone being guilty of sin. Paul, and that's Ecclesiastes has a verse in there, chapter 7:20, I think it is, where there's no one without sin. And other than that, I don't know. I mean, I guess Sermon on the Mount, maybe some of the sort of look at the lilies and the grass, which is here today, next is thrown into the oven, that sort of. I mean, there could be some Ecclesiastes kind of undergirding some of the Sermon on the Mount. We'll talk about that in due course. Anyway, let's jump into the text. Holy moly, we're almost time for a break. I'm going to read the first chapter of this, and then we'll talk about it on the other side. So here we go. I think I have done some justice to introducing this book. I'm excited to jump in. The pleasure really is in the journey, and here we go. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. There you have the text of Ecclesiastes 1. We'll dive in on the other side of a quick break.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website, www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcasts, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the Contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Hey there, folks. We are back with our brand new podcast series, a study of Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, the preacher, the gatherer, the assembler. All is vanity. That's what we heard in the first chapter. Do you believe it? Do you see that when you look at the world, when you go to work, when you, hang out with your family, your friends? Do you ever have a moment saying, vanity of vanities, all is vanity? What does it mean to be in vain? I guess there's one thing to be said here just for how we translate this stuff. So the first verse introduces us to the preacher or the gatherer, Kohelet. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So clearly we're thinking Solomon. And yet, again, Solomon's not named, and this figure of Solomon will kind of drop out after these first few chapters. And we'll kind of, again, it's just a burning question to me. What's the effect of writing this in such a way? Again, Luther, he was the first to say, I just don't think Solomon wrote this. I think, of course, we're supposed to think Solomon, but that's the thing, is that maybe the point is rather, we're thinking Solomon for a reason, even though the kind of authorship that Solomon shows elsewhere is not on display here. Now, why is that and what does it mean for reading the book is one of those questions we're going to have to kind of keep with us as we move along. So anyway, he's the preacher. He's the Kohelet. He's one who gathers. And I mean, you could say one who gathers people. But really, I mean, I'm kind of giving away the ending here in a few different ways. But based on the ending, he's one who gathers material. He gathers proverbs. He gathers wisdom for the people. I mean, I guess you could say both. He gathers wisdom and people. But he's gathering written, extant material. And so he's kind of a Kohelet must be a sort of a nickname, I guess. But again, if we're thinking in terms of Solomon, we're thinking about someone who is wealthy, someone who is wise, someone with great authority. I mean, as good as it gets, basically. You read the narrative of Kings about Solomon, and he's got it all. That's the kind of thing we're supposed to... I mean, that's kind of the effect, I think, the first thing to kind of lodge in terms of getting at an answer to that question of why this Solomon thing, association. And that is we're already thinking, look, it's as good as it gets for this individual. He's got all the money he needs. He's got all the wisdom. He's the wisest person around, and he's going to have something to tell us about wisdom. In fact, you heard at the end of the chapter, yeah, the more wisdom you get, the more pain and vexation there is. So best of luck. So there's some fascinating things to be said for this kind of the Solomonic association. Vanity of vanities, and we'll pick that up as we move along. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Okay, so, I mean, the Bible doesn't waste words on things. I think I've said that before as we move through the Psalms. Vanity of vanities, okay, so you're going to see different translations. I'm working with the ESV here, and that says vanity. The word there is hevel. Hevelim. It's technically breath or vapor. The literal meaning is ruach, like the spirit, breath, wind, vapor. You're going to get this translated in all kinds of different ways. And I'm going to spend some time talking about this because really, at the end of the day, the way that you translate this one word, it's a very key word. It comes up like almost 40 times throughout the book. The way that you translate this word is going to be huge for how you understand the book. It's just that central. So we need to talk a little bit. Again, the Hebrew is hevel. It means breath or vapor. And you're going to get translations that say meaningless. Okay, so meaningless of meaninglessness. Everything is meaningless. You're going to get useless, absurd. Some of these commentary, futility, bubble, I even saw, transience, breath. I'm going to have to show my cards here on what the ESV is. I love the ESV. It's my go-to. It's wonderful in so many ways, but I just don't know if vanity is the best way to do this. The problem with vanity is that it makes it sound like there's no meaning. Everything's vain. And it's hevel is its breath, its vapor. It's not the fact that there's no meaning, but that it's ungraspable or incomprehensible. You heard the phrase there as we read through, I think it came up a couple times, a striving after the wind. You can't grasp it. It's going to slip through your fingers. How are you going to catch the wind? A striving after the wind. All is vanity and a striving after the wind. You can't control. You can't get on to. You can't contain it. And that's the kind of. So I mean, how would you translate it then? Well, really, it's kind of a cop out. But what you should do is just put the Hebrew in there. Hevel. Everything is hevel, because that's really the best. But what would you do there? I don't know. I read one commentary. I found particularly convincing, and that is. Enigmatic. It's a fancy term, but it's just this kind of, it's the incomparability or the ungraspability of it. Not that there's a complete denial of all meaning. I don't think that's really what's going on here. And sometimes I think the word vanity kind of lends itself to that. Anyway, all right, we'll get into this more as we move along. What does man gain? verse 3, by all the toil at which he toils under the sun. This is a direct shot. It's like the primary question. This is a direct shot at what it means to be human, really. I mean, if you're going to ask, what is it? So what do you gain by going to work? All the toil that you do under the sun, what is the benefit of your labor? And now this thing, this is another thing too, is that, I mean, this is fundamental stuff. This is Genesis 2 stuff. You'll notice God creates, I mean, the more I go along in Ecclesiastes, the more I'm convinced that Genesis is kind of in the background here. And one way to look at that is, well, what happened in creation? God creates Adam and Eve. You get to Genesis 2, what happens there? Actually, before even Eve is around, Genesis 2 creates Adam and he puts him in the garden to work it and to keep it. It's perfect. There are no thorns and thistles yet. And yet he puts him there to work it. There's something very fundamental about work as regards what it means to be human. I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, it'd be great to just have a day off and vacation and not do anything. But what is it about humanity that says, I mean, that boredom comes along and said, boy, I'm so bored. I wish there was something to do. Why can't you be bored? What's that restlessness inside? This sort of, well, if you're made in the image of God, God acts for his people. God does stuff. He's acting toward others, namely us, all the time. If we're created in the image of God, what is it inside us that drives us? Well, by virtue of being created in the image of God, there's that natural instinct to serve others, to be doing something, to find a fulfillment in doing something, having a vocation, serving others. There's something very fundamental. It's in the DNA about that. Here's the direct shot then. He's posing a question about what do we gain? What's the benefit? What's the yitron, another Hebrew term from yatar, to be left over, to remain? What's left over in all the work? And this is used multiple times throughout the book, and I think it's only in Ecclesiastes. What's the yitron of your work? In some ways, this invites us to go on a journey. What's the benefit of your labor? I mean, what's the benefit of what is so fundamental to who you are and what you do? And now we get into this kind of a poem. A generation comes, a generation goes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down and hastens to its place. The wind blows, goes around, its circuits, the streams, all these things. Everything's full of weariness. So you're working along. And is there anything to be said for it? Is there any benefit? Is there anything left over? Is it just going to be, at the end of the day, gone and forgotten? What at the end of the day is what is it going to do for you? And so this poem comes up and says, well, there's really nothing. Things come, things go. The sea and the wind, it's a circular, it's repetitive. Comes up, comes down. The streams. There's no final answers. Everything's full of weariness. We can't even utter it. There's no closure. What has been is what will be. What's been done, what you're doing now, somebody else is going to come along and do what you're doing. You know, nothing new. Do you believe this? I mean, it's kind of lost in time. You know, is anybody going to remember anything that any of us are doing? It's kind of ironic there in verse 9. Nothing's going to be remembered. Sorry, verse 11. Nothing's going to be remembered. And yet at the end of the day, he'll end the book by saying, remember your creator. We'll talk about that later. But is there a thing of which it has said, see, this is new. There is nothing new under the sun. Is that true? Is the iPhone 6 better than the iPhone? Is that new? Is not? It's better than the iPhone 5. Is there something? What is completely and utterly new? Well, on the one hand, I mean, we forget it now, but it really was the Enlightenment, basically, where we started thinking that things are getting better and better and there are actually new and utterly completely new things. Throughout most of the centuries, Christian history and history of interpretation, it was the exact opposite. The best stuff had already happened. And the ancient, with the wisdom there and everything, it was all kind of downhill from there. I mean, as history moves along, the more you move along, the more wars, rumors of wars, the end times, it's going to get worse and worse. Now we like to think of it in the opposite. But this question, is there anything new? I mean, that's the, at the end of the day, anything, let's say a new invention comes, like a computer comes along. Well, every new invention gives and it takes. Boy, now we have a smartphone, so we can connect with anybody all over the world. We can get emergencies. It'll help us out. And at the same time, so it gives us those things. At the same time, what does it take? It takes attention from loved ones. We text at the dinner table all the time. It's rude. Students do it in class all the time. Are you bored? Well, another world awaits you at your fingertips. Go ahead. It's there. Go. Where do you want to go? You want to see the sports? You want to go on Facebook? You want to text? You want to chat? You want to play games? Whatever. Everything gives and takes. Computers, hey, wonderful technology. We can do amazing things. We email, we do all this. Oh, that's great. And yet at the same time, what is all this information for? We don't really know how to prioritize things. Or it's now an instrument to do something that's detrimental. Hey, a computer's around, so here are some things you shouldn't be looking at. And that can affect marriages and friendships, and you know, now you bully online, and now it's going to destroy relationships. Well, all because the computer can't. Everything gives and it takes. And so is there anything really that is absolutely new? I mean, there are some things. I mean, we're all under the same cloth of sin, whether King David or Luther or those of us in 2016. Same broken world, same sinful flesh, same words of the gospel by which we live. So is there anything that is utterly new? Can anything come from nothing? I'm going to get real philosophical here about creation out of nothing, we confess, and things like that. Well, God can do that, but since then, is there anything new? If so, what in what sense? It's a central question. We're going to lodge that and track that as we move forward. You can already tell I have thoughts on that. This idea, though, that we have in our culture these days that, boy, this is completely and utterly new. I think we have to ask ourselves, in what sense? Because we have this kind of illusion floating around there that we can just, if we have this sense, that if we can just get on top of things and get beyond things and kind of progress beyond things, we can kind of escape whatever we don't like about whatever humanity and the way things are. Boy, we're going to have to keep that in check as we move through this book. The other thing to point out here before we move on, and I'm going to do a few bonus minutes. I know we're basically out of time, but I'm going to push this a little bit since it's kind of a new one. We'll start out with a bang. I hope it'll all go okay. But you'll see here that Qoheleth is using his senses to figure this all out. So the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. He's going to test all of this through his own observations. He's going to put wisdom to the test through what he can gather. Pun intended, he's the gatherer, right? So I, the preacher, been king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my heart to seek and search out. And it's a central thing. That's the whole person. I put my whole heart and soul. You can see these Olympic athletes. We're in the Olympics right now. You can see these athletes. They're putting in everything they got. They come around that final lap or whatever. They are everything. He's putting his heart into it, heart and soul, you could say, his whole person, to figure out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. That's fascinating because, it's a bit ironic. By wisdom, well, what kind of wisdom are you talking about? Is it the wisdom that we're given in like Proverbs or Deuteronomy and so on? What kind of wisdom is being put to the test here? Well, as I said, we're talking about his observations, his abilities to kind of figure this out on a kind of ground level approach. He's going to apply his heart. Everything that he has in his own flesh, that kind of wisdom. What are we going to figure? And it's all, you notice all the eyes. I applied. I have seen. I have done this. So he's going to do this kind of personal investigation with his own conscience. Now, that's one form of wisdom, one approach, but there's more to the story as far as what wisdom ultimately is. And this is an unhappy business. See, you see how Genesis, again, is kind of flipped on its head? The task in Genesis was a good thing. I've made these things. It's very good. Behold, that's good. God saw that it was good. And the word there really is kind of evil. It's evil or unhappy. This is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Well, again, what kind of wisdom is being employed here? The kind of wisdom that comes from your heart and your observations? That's going to get unhappy real quick. you're going to see some things that are, yeah, vanity of vanities, or enigmatic, or ungraspable. You're going to find those real quick. Everything under the sun, boy, it's a vanity and a striving after the wind when you apply that kind of wisdom. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I've got great wisdom surpassing everybody. See, that's the thing. The Solomon, we're supposed to think like as good as it gets here, Solomon. I applied my heart to know wisdom, to know madness and folly. But even that, even knowing things on this level, through my eyes, through my observations, with my heart, as I look around, the more that kind of wisdom came to me, Kohelet says, the more vexation I dealt with, the more I increased in sorrow. There's something very profound about, you know, some of the geniuses that most tragically take their lives or are in severe bouts of depression or whatever the case is. In other words, the kind of mind that's so wise that knows almost too much about the human condition. In much wisdom is much vexation. If you're going to, this kind of wisdom, looking around with the eyes and the ears and applying the heart to get, you know, a great wisdom and to know what madness is and to know what stupidity is and to know all those things about humanity in a kind of earthly level, yeah, you shuffle out that wisdom enough and you're going to keep banging your head against the wall, basically. You're going to keep realizing the fact that even everything I've got, all my heart, and all the wisdom I can muster on a kind of earthly level is going to remind me again and again of my own limitations. And the more I know about my own limitations, the more I'm just vexed with my own condition. There's nothing new here. I can't be satisfied by eye, by ear. My heart is still restless. And the more I know about life, about the sinful condition, about humanity, the more I know about the way things are in this world, Kohelet says, the more I actually increase in sorrow, the more I'm actually depressed about the whole thing. Yikes. Well, that's one approach to figuring out what's going on here in this toil under the sun. And yet at the same time, we know wisdom incarnate. We know who is the wisdom of God who comes and gives meaning and purpose and value to life that cannot be achieved by our own senses or by our own endeavors, as Kohelet would have it, but ultimately comes to us freely by grace, not as an abstract concept, but as a person. Lots of fun things to talk about ahead. I hope you are at least intrigued by the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm excited to dive more into this book with you. Really hope you enjoy this one. Gotta cut it there today, but please consider mentioning this podcast to your family and friends so that they too can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.